Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. Often forgotten and overlooked, the U.S.-Mexican War featured false starts, atrocities, and daring back-channel negotiations as it divided the nation, paved the way for the Civil War a generation later, and launched the career of Abraham Lincoln. Historian Amy Greenberg looks to bring this American War for Empire to life with memorable characters, plot lines, and legacies. A Wicked War is a definitive history of the 1846 conflict. It paints an intimate portrait of the major players and their world. It is the story of Indian fights, manifest destiny, secret military maneuvers, gunshot wounds, and political spin. Along the way, it captures a young Lincoln mismatching his clothes, the lasting influence of the Founding Fathers, the birth of the Daughters of the American Revolution, and, above all, America's first national anti-war movement. Amy Greenberg is Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of History and Women's Studies at Penn State University. It is a pleasure to welcome her to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe.
Very nice to have you here. What got you interested in this conflict, in the subject of wanting to bring it to the fore, if you will, of dedicating much time and obviously many pages in describing this war?
Well, I'm a historian. I'm a professor of history at Penn State, and I've been working on the issue of manifest destiny for a long time now, longer than I'd even like to say. And what I found is that there weren't any books out there about the U.S.-Mexico War that I liked. What I mean by that is that most of the books that historians have written about the U.S.-Mexico War, and I'd like to make clear that there really aren't that many of them because people don't necessarily like thinking about or talking about this war as opposed to, say, the Civil War, the Revolution, which are kind of happier conflicts. Anyhow, most of the books that were out there were written by military historians and really focused on battles, what happened in battles. And what I was really interested in, both as a scholar and as a teacher, was kind of what happened to people. So I wanted a book that I could teach to my students that really explained how this war impacted individuals and impacted the nation, a narrative that was character-driven, that was compelling, and that also talked about the impact of the war on American politics. So not so much the story of the battles, although I know that those are important, but really the story of, like, what did this war mean to America and to Americans? So that was the book that I set out to write and hopefully did write.
When you look at the approach that you took to this book, obviously much has been written about Polk, much has been written about Henry Clay, much has been written about Abraham Lincoln, and your approach really does differ, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, a lot has been written about Abraham Lincoln and about Polk, and less about Clay, but certainly a lot. But, you know, I don't think anybody before now had really written about the relationships between these characters because they were all connected to each other by this war and during this war. And, you know, I also found in the course of my research some other really compelling characters who played major roles in bringing the war to a close. Characters like Nicholas Trist, a diplomat who negotiated the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which brought the war to a close, even though he had been recalled by Polk. He was negotiating without any official sanction, and much to his president's dismay, he negotiated a treaty that really gave the United States less land than Polk wanted. So I wrote about him, and I learned about a guy named John Hardin, who was Abraham Lincoln's main political rival in Illinois politics before he got to Congress. Hardin really, had he not died in the U.S.-Mexico War at a young age, in a very tragic way, he might very well have become the great Whig politician of Illinois, and not Lincoln. Certainly at the time that he volunteered to lead Illinois troops to the war, he was the leading Whig politician of the region, and Lincoln was a really pretty far down on the ladder in terms of significance compared to John Hardin.
They're about the same age, and yeah, they were very good friends. And And as you say, and had he survived the U.S.-Mexico War, he may very well have overshadowed Lincoln in the 1850s. What is interesting in how you portray him in the book is how fascinating he is as a character. He is a character.
Yeah, yeah, he is. He was a character at the time. I don't think there's very many people like John Hardin in politics anymore. I mean, you could actually say there aren't very many people like Henry Clay or Abraham Lincoln or any of these people, but Hardin struck me as really kind of an interesting example of his time, which is that he was really a warrior. He fought in the Black Hawk War. He led troops there. He helped lead the Mormons out of Illinois, and he really, really wanted to fight Mexico, despite the fact that he was a leader of the opposition party. So he was, even though he didn't necessarily believe Polk when Polk said that Mexico had started a war against the United States, even though he had very skeptical about Polk and his goals, he anxiously volunteered and led troops to Mexico and really believed in his role in the American military. But at the same time, he was a man of incredible privilege. He was very wealthy. He was well-liked by men and women. He was a very skilled politician. He loved raising and riding horses. So I just don't, you know, if you look at Congress today, there aren't really that many people who are in Congress who, if the opposition president started a war, would resign their position and head off to fight personally in the war that's just been declared, although that happened a lot in the U.S.-Mexico War.
When you, in writing about him, you also obviously write about Nicholas Trist, as you mentioned. Here's another guy who is often ignored by scholars, but what he did was incredibly brave. He defied Polk's orders to leave Mexico. He negotiated a peace treaty. The treaty itself is relatively generous to Mexico, and he knew that it would cost him his career, and it did.
Yeah. Yeah, Trist he's a pretty tragic figure. Polk was so angry that Trist disobeyed his orders that he withheld Trist's pay when Trist returned from Mexico, all pay that he had accrued after the date that Polk dismissed him. He didn't pay Trist, and the Trist family, they needed money, and Trist spent the next decade after he got back from the war with Mexico without any employment through the government, really basically in poverty with his family. And it really wasn't until after the Civil War that President Grant, actually, who was a young lieutenant, actually, in the U.S.-Mexico War, when Grant was president, was the first time, really, that the nation acknowledged Trist's sacrifice and actually gave him a position. So, see, yeah, when he negotiated the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, he wrote to his wife and he said, you know, I think I may never work in government again. And he was absolutely right. But the reason that he negotiated that treaty is because he was convinced that the war had to be brought to a close. He not only, he wrote, felt sympathy for the people of Mexico, but he actually really didn't think that the United States wanted to take any more of Mexico than the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo suggested. So there are a lot of expansionists in the government, including Polk himself, who, you know, by late fall of 1847, are looking towards Baja California and Sonora, California, and they have this very expansive idea of how much of Mexico the U.S. can take, particularly since the United States is occupying Mexico City and in control of Mexico City. And Trist basically, you know, he actually talks to General Scott, Winfield Scott, who's the commander of the troops, and Scott agrees with him. He's like, you know what, we got to get out of here. Let's bring this war to a close. I know that you actually legally cannot negotiate this treaty, but go ahead and do it. And Trist is able to go to the Mexican diplomats and say, look, this is our best chance to get a treaty out of this. If I'm actually recalled and you guys don't, come to the table with me. The next person they send is going to take a lot more of your country. In fact, you may not even exist as a country if you don't come to the table right now and we don't hammer out an agreement.
We're talking to Amy Greenberg. The name of the new book is A Wicked War, Polk, Clay, Lincoln, and the 1846 U.S. Invasion of Mexico. The book is published by Knopf and is endlessly fascinating. You do write about Abraham Lincoln. You write about his opposition to the U.S.-Mexican War and ultimately how that war influenced his future political career. In writing about Lincoln as a character, what was it that fascinated about him in writing about him during those early years of his political career?
Oh, well, you know, I'm not the only person who finds Abraham Lincoln endlessly fascinating. I think a large proportion of the book reading population does too. I mean, he's our great American hero. You know, he's always the president that Americans say they admire most, and for very, very good reason. And yet, people do not know much about him before the 1850s. And, you know, here we have Abraham Lincoln's first exposure on the national stage. He gets elected to Congress in 1846. He travels out there in between when he's elected and when he actually makes it to Washington, D.C. This war is being fought. Lincoln at first doesn't seem to have any interest about the war at all. And yet when he gets to Congress, he makes his first big national speech, which is much more widely written about and spoken about, I discovered in my research, than most people, you know, had ever noted. Most people have always said, well, Lincoln's opposition to the war was sort of overlooked nationally, but I found that really was not the case. But anyhow, Lincoln gets to Congress, and he gets up, and he gives a speech, and he basically calls Polk a liar. So Lincoln devotes his energies when he first gets to Congress, which is something he had desperately wanted to do. He desperately wanted to be elected to Congress for years, and he finally made it there. And what does he talk about? He talks about the U.S.-Mexico War. And I just thought that was amazing and something that people should know about, because it really isn't something that people know about.
And you talk about how this really shaped him in the sense that it gave him this first taste of national fame, which was really widely reported.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I was able to actually determine that by using online newspaper databases and simply looking up the speech. So I think scholars in the past who had said that people didn't really notice Lincoln's speech, they didn't have the technology available that we as historians have now in order to see, well, you know, actually newspapers around the country are talking about Lincoln's speech and they're commenting on it. People knew about it.
Give us a one thing, as I mentioned in the introduction, that here is a conflict that gave birth to America's first national anti-war movement. What brought that to be?
Okay. When the war starts in May of 1846, the American people are overwhelmingly in favor of it. There are many, many more men who volunteer to fight in this war than Polk can take. So extreme enthusiasm for the war, but that enthusiasm cools off very quickly, and it cools off for a number of reasons. First of all, there are embedded journalists who are traveling with the troops, and they report back home about various activities that the troops are involved in that the American people don't necessarily support, among which are atrocities against civilians. So the troops, particularly the volunteers, are not behaving in the way that the American public would like to think that they would behave when they're in another country. They are stealing things, raping Mexican women, murdering civilians, and this stuff gets reported in newspapers. So that really doesn't look good. Second thing that really turns the American people against the war is that even though the U.S. wins battle after battle, definitively, U.S. forces are almost always outnumbered by large percentages by Mexican forces, and yet they manage to win battles in, like, really often very heroic manners, but yet Mexico won't concede. So what the American people want is a short, quick, relatively painless war. And what they end up with is a drawn-out, long war with many, many casualties, most of which are due to disease, and no end in sight. Also, the American people are really not sure how much they actually want to annex large portions of Mexican territory because there's a great deal of racism and anti-Catholicism in the United States, and a lot of people in the U.S. are not really sure that Mexicans would make very good American citizens. That was the feeling that they had. So you have these factors, among others, that basically lead a lot of American people, including a lot of soldiers in the field, to want to get out of Mexico as soon as possible and to question whether or not the war was a good idea in the first place.
You also, as I mentioned, the birth of the Daughters of the American Revolution. You write about this, and it's fascinating how that came about. My mother, being a longtime member of the Daughters of the American Revolution and being a regent, I had no idea how the Daughters were formed.
Okay, my mother's also a member of the DAR. And I have to tell you that as a historian, these are like the moments that we live for. It's the moment that I realized that John Hardin's daughter Ellen, who he wrote letters to and received letters from during the Mexican War, and I read all these letters. She's 14 when her father is in Mexico. And they're writing letters back and forth. And I said to myself, who is this Ellen Hardin? I'd love to know what happened to her. Because she seemed very smart in these letters, very interesting young lady. But, of course, she changed her name, like most women did at the time, and I couldn't find out anything about her until one day I stumbled upon a reference in an old 19th century book about Central Illinois that said that Ellen Hardin went on to marry a guy named Walworth and became Ellen Hardin Walworth. And as soon as I figured that out and I began to look her up, I realized she was one of the four women who founded the Daughters of the American Revolution. And at that point, I was able to get all kinds of information about her because the DAR has a remarkable library. And the guy that she married, Walworth, Chancellor Walworth, was the last chancellor of the state of New York, and all of his family papers were up in Saratoga. So suddenly, I had this like wealth of information, and I realized that Ellen Hardin Walworth becomes this extremely important figure in late 19th century history, and the founder of this association that, you know, I believe something like 700,000 women have joined the Daughters of the American Revolution since it started.
It is it's a fascinating story, and how you end the book. I have to say, and we're running out of time, and there's so much in here that I made so many notes in the margin and things I wanted to ask you about. But one of the other things, just real quick, because I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about it. Oh my God, your writing of Polk's marriage, fascinating stuff.
Thank you. Yeah, nobody really had noticed up until this time that Sarah Polk was actually a pretty important political figure.
Very modern marriage, if you think of it.
Totally modern marriage, right. So, that's something that I hope readers will get something out of reading about this. I mean, Sarah Polk is, she was really a remarkable person. They were childless, and very early on, they kind of made it their joint mission to expand America's boundaries and to make Manifest Destiny a reality through this war. I mean, she was very much a political partner of his, much more, I think, sort of in the mold of what you saw with Bill and Hillary Clinton than anything that was happening at the time.
A Wicked War is the name of the book, Polk, Clay, Lincoln, and the 1846 U.S. Invasion of Mexico. The book is published by Knopf. As I said, it is endlessly fascinating and beautifully written. Amy, thank you so much for sharing with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you. And I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the book. I really appreciate it. Thank you.